It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Green Bay has a growing Somali-American population. We'll talk to two women living in the city who helped write a new book about the experience of Somali immigrants in Wisconsin. First, we age from the minute we're born, and if we keep doing it long enough, we reach what's called old age. According to U.S. Census data, the number of people 65 and over is projected to reach almost 95 million by the year 2040. And the 85 and over population is projected to more than double by then to 14.4 million people. But our next guest says when it comes to medicine and our culture, we often treat aging like a disease rather than a phase of life. And that could be bad news for the health care we provide for older people, but there are things we can do to make improvements. Dr. Louise Aronson is a geriatrician, educator, and professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Her new book is called Elderhood: Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, Reimagining Life. Dr. Aronson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, you say we treat aging in many ways in our culture like a disease, a medical condition. How does that seep into the way we treat people as they get older?
Well, it makes them by definition impaired or ill in some way. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but it equates an entire huge segment of the population and a whole phase of life with something pathological. We don't tend to do that at other phases, and each phase of life has its pros and cons. So although there's some pretty exciting science about aging, I think conflating the two really diminishes how we think creatively about the opportunities that old age provides for us, both as individuals and as a society.
You write that among other cultural biases about aging, there's one in the medical community. People don't often think to go into geriatrics, and it tends to be looked down on. Because of that, I'll ask, why did you pursue this as your line of work?
I love that question. Well, you know, I had no intention. Like most medical students, I didn't hear much about geriatrics. And what happened was just by chance, I trained initially in internal medicine, so medicine for adults. And I just by chance had a clinic that had a lot of older patients in it. So I began to realize that although I was at the best primary care training program in the country, I wasn't learning how to meet many of their needs. I was learning about common diseases that happened in adults generally. Not much about the diseases specifically that become more common with aging, or importantly, about how those diseases that we also get as adults manifest and are treated differently as we get older. I also, in the hospital, kept seeing really horrifying things where people who were older would get basically the same, you know, say somebody was 85, they would get the same treatment for whatever they had as we would give to a 55-year-old. And they would often end up dying or suffering. And sometimes when people said, well, this isn't working, let's withdraw care, they would actually blossom and do better. And instead of sending them home on hospice, I'd simply send them home. And all those things gave me a sense that there was, that we weren't doing things the right way, and also that there was an opportunity to make a huge difference for a part of life that we all, if we get lucky, will arrive at.
Why do we have this blind spot? There are so many different examples you give of ways in which we kind of get medicine and related treatment for seniors wrong. Why do we have so many gaps in our treatment system?
Well, part of it is that there weren't so many older people until just recently in history. So we really were set up to treat the people who existed then. And it takes a long time to make a cultural shift. But I think that's actually been worsened and compounded by ageism, which is ubiquitous. You will find, or at least I find, so I live in San Francisco. We're known as a liberal city. And, you know, there are good reasons for that. We don't do everything perfectly, but we really have a sense of respecting all different sorts of people. And yet you can hear people from all different ages and backgrounds, including older people themselves, make jokes about old people that if you replace the word old with woman or person of color or gay or lesbian would be entirely unacceptable. And, you know, doctors, nurses, other people in healthcare are human beings and products of culture like everyone else. So we have said on the one hand, for instance, in research, that older people are different from younger people. So we're not going to put them in our studies because, you know, they just complicate things. And yet we'll take the results of those studies and we'll apply them to older people. And then when things go badly, because the people are different, we blame old age instead of the bad science that led us to administer treatments to people when we don't have any proof that they help them. In clinical care, we have children's hospitals and adult hospitals, children's specialists and adult specialists of all different kinds. And yet all of us know that an 85-year-old looks as different from a 35-year-old as an 8-year-old does. And they're different socially, they're different behaviorally, they're different physiologically, yet we don't give older people the same respect and opportunities, the same tailored health systems to their particular life stage that we give everyone else, that we give children and adults. And that's why in the book I really talk about thinking about elderhood as the decades-long varied stage of life that it is, and a perfect analog in old age to childhood for kids and adulthood for adults.
Talking to Dr. Louise Aronson about her new book. It's called Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, Reimagining Life. Let's talk about that concept at the center of your book some more, Dr. Aronson. Elderhood, it's not a sense of, okay, this is decline or this is the period of life where we give up or people give up on it, on us. What is your positive definition of elderhood?
Well, my positive is just, I don't even think it needs to be positive. It just needs to be neutral and equivalent to childhood and adulthood. So if childhood lasts, let's say, our first 20 years, traditionally throughout history, this was actually fascinating, throughout history and cultures, almost everyone has defined old age as beginning between the years of 60 and 70. And people, when they look at other people, will call them old beginning in that age range. But when it comes to themselves, they generally won't, because we have begun to associate. I know it's actually, and we all do it. You know, I talk about in the book how I'm in my mid-50s, but as I entered my 50s, I began making those comments everybody makes. Even though I've spent, you know, decades now working on old age, we are all products of the culture. So this isn't about blaming. It's about recognizing the opportunity we have to do better in ways that will help all of us. So I guess when I think of elderhood, I think of it beginning somewhere between the ages of 60 and 70 and lasting the next 30, 40, 50 years, depending on how long you live. And just as for childhood, we have neonates, infants, toddlers, young kids, tweens, teens. And for adulthood, we have young adults and middle-aged and maybe early seniors. So too in elderhood do we have people who are widely different in what they do and how they live. So when we talk about older people are a burden, I think we're not really using the evidence we have at hand, which is that people in their 70s, for example, are the fastest growing segment of the workforce. Equally, that people in old age get happier and much less anxious. This begins in people's late 50s, and the data shows that in countries like the United States, so this is not true of the very poorest countries, but in countries like the U.S., people begin getting happier and much less anxious around 60, and things just get better for a couple decades after that. Now, does that include the growing percentage of people who have serious illness? Not always, but actually sometimes it does. Recent studies have shown that most older adults rate their health as good, very good, or excellent. And that's not because they can do at 78 what they did at 38, but because, all things considered, they are having a good life and their health is adequate to let them enjoy that life.
One medical point that you run across a lot of times in your career is that sometimes something goes wrong for a person over age 60, and people, maybe even medical professionals, just chalk it up to, well, that's just normal. That's what happens when you get old. And you find case after case where that leads to people missing the actual problem that's going on. How do we get past that assumption that it's just natural?
I think old age should not be a diagnosis unless you're really looking at basic science of you know, aging, which is a whole other conversation. But clinically, you know, I tell this joke in the book. It's one of my favorite jokes of all time, actually, which is, and this happened actually in New York, 97-year-old man wasn't able to see his regular doctor. So he went into the doctor because he was having pain in one of his knees. And the doctor asked the usual questions, did the exam it ever? And then he said, well, you know, what do you expect? The knee is 97. And the man's response was, well, my other knee is 97 too, and it doesn't bother me a bit. So that to me just encompasses the entire problem, that health things are more common as we age, just as the need for education is more common in childhood and the need for occupational training is more common in adulthood. At different phases of life, we have different primary needs. In old age, we have more needs for health. But that just means we're more likely to get certain conditions. It doesn't mean that we are ourselves a pathology.
Dr. Louise Aronson is with us. She's a geriatrician and the author of the new book, Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, Reimagining Life. Let's bring on a caller now. We have Elizabeth with us in Milwaukee. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Elizabeth?
I've worked in nursing homes in my 20s, 30s, and 40s, and a woman put me in my place one time. I was very condescending, and I sat down in a chair, and I learned, who do I think I am? And it's not because I'm older now, but what I realized is all of us in America, wherever, will be old one day or whatever you want to call it. We're human beings, and the things that I learned were just phenomenal. And even in 2019, when I see someone, people might call people that are getting older, whatever, and I don't even know how to define the age, sweetie, kiddo, hun, patting them on the head, very condescending, like they're children on a TV program that I've watched, you know, in the last 30 years. Dr. Anderson, I feel so wonderful listening to you. I feel like you're the first person that's ever said what I felt in my soul. And it's not because I'm getting older. I knew it in my 20s, 30s, and 40s after this woman let me know what she thought. And she gave me the best wisdom I ever experienced. And I loved it.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for the call. Dr. Aronson, what do you think?
Oh, I thought that was a great comment. Thank you, Elizabeth. It also reminded me of two things. One that I forgot to say when you asked me why I became a geriatrician, and the reason was the stories. If you're a person who likes stories or likes interacting with people, dealing with older people or being with older people is an absolute pleasure because they have more of them over more time. So that was one thing I neglected to say. Elizabeth also touched on wisdom and the way in which we tend to infantilize or disregard old people. It's as if the people part is gone, and it demoralizes people. And it actually, in studies, what we find is that people begin apologizing for their very existence in ways that they didn't before. If a pregnant woman who's very pregnant needs a hand with something, or if somebody breaks their leg and needs a little more time to cross the street, people don't deny their very humanity, but that happens routinely to older people. And she spoke of times where other people were condescending or treating them like children. The other thing that happens is that they're treated as if they're simply not there. So people will ask the person beside the older person a question as if the older person can't hear or speak for themselves, which is crazy. And it's really bad because I have rarely spoken to an older adult, and I've probably spoken to many tens of thousands at this point, who doesn't say that the strangest experience they have in old age is looking in the mirror, because inside they feel exactly the same. So imagine yourself now, whatever age you are, and then having people treat you as if you're a three-year-old, or as if you can't speak for yourself, or have no control over your own life. There's nothing about that anybody would enjoy.
Thanks a lot for sharing your story, Elizabeth. Dr. Aronson, is there a movement in the medical world to change that bedside manner when it comes to talking to seniors instead of about them and avoiding that, as you said, infantilizing language?
Well, in medicine, we've been pretty good on the infantilizing language, at least, you know, in certain professions. I understand that it still happens in various places. It's a little bit geographically varied as well. But certainly in most professional training programs, we are taught not to call any patients honey or dear or any, you know, you call them by their names first or last according to their preference. In terms of treating people with respect, we have a ways to go. So sometimes in medical training, people will be taught a little bit about communicating across language barriers or across differences such as hearing loss in people who are deaf. But we don't do enough to talk about the ways in which we interact with people of different backgrounds and people who are older. And that includes people who may have cognitive impairment from dementia or who may have relatively new hearing loss or visual loss as they age from various diseases, or even just how to treat someone whose response is a little slower because maybe they're 98 years old, but they're actually mentally entirely there. How do you distinguish between a person who's just fine but responding more slowly and a person who might be having a delirium related to their illness? That should be happening all the time, and yet people will often assume people have dementia when they don't, or not consider they do have dementia when they have really fluid, charming speech, and that really leads to bad medical care.
Talking to Dr. Louise Aronson about her book, Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, Reimagining Life. Back to your calls now. Chris is on the line in Adams. Chris, hello.
Good afternoon. I have sort of a peculiar situation. I've been sick since I was a child and went through this whole process of the doctors not being able to figure out what was going on. I basically self-diagnosed with the help of a naturopath, went through that whole thing. And I'm 64 years old now. And what I noticed in going through my entire life with these illnesses is that when you're young, you're supposed to be able to function. And when you don't, people are very judgmental, critical, and cruel. But you get to be an older person and you say, oh, God, I'm having a really, really bad day today, which is the same bad day that you had when you were 25 or 30 or 35. But people have some empathy for that. And I actually feel better now because I have taken my health care into my own hands and I have figured it out. And I do everything I can to make myself as healthy as possible.
Chris, I'm going to jump in because we don't have too much time. Dr. Aronson, she says, well, on the one hand, she feels she gets more sympathy being sick when she's older. But on the other hand, maybe if that young person has a physical problem, they diagnose that as an illness. If that older person has that physical problem, they again diagnose it as old age.
Right. It's so many good points. What she's describing for her younger self is something called ableism, which is a sort of prejudice against people who don't have what we consider normal abilities at any age, although ableism tends to be applied more to younger people because, as she said, we expect younger people to all function perfectly, even though we know they don't, that people acquire or are born with a variety of problems. So I think these things are linked. On the one hand, it's fantastic that now she's getting more sympathy and help. The flip side of that is for people who are still fine, but are in their 60s, 70s, 80s, or 90s, who are assumed to be not fine. And this sort of brings us back to the previous caller and treated that way when they are able. So I think one of the things we can and should do for people of all ages is to consider, are they able or do they have some challenges? And be nice to them either way. And if you're not sure, just ask. Because actually people with the same abilities or disabilities have really different and personal preferences about how and when they'd like to be helped. The best thing to do is to respect them as full human beings and ask, what can I do something? What can I do to help?
Thanks for that call, Chris. Dr. Aronson, are you starting to see some signs of positive movement here? You talk in the book about these units called ACE units, for example, being in more and more hospitals.
Right. So there's lots of positive movement both in society and in medicine. So the ACE unit stands for Acute Care for Elders. And these are units where people get specific treatment for things that happen as they age. So really, the functional loss that can happen in a hospital happens much more quickly to older adults. So if people don't get up and walking, they are less likely to be able to walk when they leave. So, for example, you might come in with a pneumonia. The pneumonia gets treated, but then suddenly you can't walk because nobody's gotten you out of bed in a few days. And consequently, you have to go to a nursing home, which is most older people's greatest fear. So in these units, people would get the older person up and moving. They would do all sorts of things to prevent delirium, which is a confusional state that can happen to any patient, but happens more commonly with old age and acute illness. There are also some really exciting advances in surgery, general surgery, orthopedic surgery, really thinking about something called prehab, which is like rehab, right? Rehab is after we're going to try and restore your function. But prehab is, hey, let's get you in the best possible shape before your surgery. So maybe you won't need so much rehab or any rehab because you're going to sail through the surgery more successfully than you would have previously. So there is huge progress. I will say that there are already many very well-proven programs to help older patients and to optimize their medical care, but they tend to be adopted at much lower levels than programs for other populations. So that's something we could change right now if we were really thinking about the health of the populace. It's sort of ironic that on the one hand, we get all this drama about, oh, the aging population, the horror, you know, people use that horrible term, silver tsunami, as if aging is all bad, and they all wished they would die suddenly at age 55. But they talk about the horror, and yet they don't do the evidence-based treatments and set up the evidence-based systems we know that would decrease health costs and increase the health and function of older people. So you can't really have it both ways.
Dr. Aronson, thanks for joining us. That's Dr. Louise Aronson, geriatrician, educator, and professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Her new book is called Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, Reimagining Life. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Green Bay has a growing Somali-American population, and for the last 2 years, a group of young women called the United Re Sisters has been working to highlight their presence. In a new book called The First Winter, 12 of the women write about settling in Wisconsin, keeping a connection to their family's heritage, and a lot more. Nada Kasim and Zemzem Noor are members of the United Re Sisters of Green Bay and two of the authors of the book. They joined us earlier today from our Green Bay studio. Nada, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And Zemzem, thanks for coming up to our Green Bay studio.
Thank you.
Well, Zemzem, let's talk about the book a little bit first. It has a little bit of everything, personal stories, some poems, some letters. What do you hope people come away with after they read everything that you and the other writers have written?
Well, the Somali community in Green Bay is fairly recent, and people don't know very much about us and what we stand for and, like, our beliefs. And we want them to know that, like, we're not just a bunch of people that are, like, that just wear headscarves and, like, don't know anything. We just want them to know that we're really like them, and we want them to know that we strive for the same things as people here in Green Bay do, and, yeah.
And Nada, mentioning the headscarf reminds me, you write in the book, I think you had a hard time finding certain clothes, so you learned to make your own. Could you talk about that experience?
Yeah, when I first came to Green Bay and we went to stores and I couldn't find clothes that are like things I could wear. So my dad back in Somalia used to work as a, used to sew clothes for people. So that my mom always told me about that. And when I couldn't find clothes, I went to YouTube and asked mom to purchase the machine for me and try to see stuff that I could wear for myself.
And Zemzem, can you tell us a little bit about United Re Sisters and a little more about what you're working on in Green Bay?
Well, the United Re Sisters is a group. It's a grassroots organization that began in April 2017, and it was created as a safe place for young Somali women to to meet and make connections with other female community members in an effort to build friendships and support systems. We used to meet every week to just have to talk, have tea and snacks, and we did a lot of art while we were there. We actually started with a project, a mural, and it began to share our stories with one another. And we received a grant from the Women's Fund organization that actually helped us write the book that we have now.
And Nada, I want to talk about your story. You and your family left Somalia because of the civil war there. You spent a lot of your childhood in a refugee camp in Ethiopia. once you finally arrived in Green Bay, what were some of the first things you thought about this new, very different city?
Green Bay was really welcoming, and I went to school. I started sophomore at East High School, and I loved the people there, the students. The teachers were really helping, trying to help us with the English to settle and learn quicker and be with the other students with the level they are.
And you'd started learning English in the refugee camp in Ethiopia, is that right?
Yeah, we did, but it wasn't English that we practiced. It was more like writing and vocab words.
Mm-hmm. And you have sisters that you were in the camp there. You're here in Green Bay together. Seems like you sisters are a really important part of each other's lives.
Yeah, we are. We've been together. We started from first grade together and still in college. And yeah, we've always been together.
Zamzam, I want to talk about your story. Now, you had grown up in the United States until I think 12 years old, and then you moved, much of your family moved to Somalia for 2 years, and you write about that. What was it like coming from that perspective, going from the U.S. to Somalia?
Well, at first, it was a huge culture shock for me because I only ever knew life in America. And when I went there, like, I met family members I never knew I had. I experienced things that I would never experience if I hadn't gone. I found my passion there, and it was a really great experience.
Talk about that passion. You confirmed a career course while you were there.
Yeah, while I was there, I kind of knew I wanted to be a doctor when I was little, and when I went there, it kind of solidified that fact because I came across instances that were really heartbreaking of women losing their babies when they're giving birth, and I actually did some research, and Somalia has a really high infant mortality rate, and I really want to help fix that. So I want to become an OBGYN when I'm older.
And Nada, you are going to UW Green Bay now yourself. Do you see a career path ahead for you? If you're a sophomore, I think you still have time.
Yeah, I'm studying human biology right now, and I'm planning on going to med school.
Can you talk now? We mentioned that you were making your own clothes in the Somali style, and that's something that for people in the United States, seeing someone wear a headscarf or hijab or one of the different permutations we don't see all the time, a lot of the co-authors talk about the kind of reactions people have. What kind of things do you see when you're out in public? What kind of reactions do you get?
People stare at us a lot, and I would rather come to me and ask me questions about why I'm wearing it and what is it to me, then just stare at me and have assumptions and just walk away.
Zamzam, do you feel singled out in that way sometimes, but people aren't willing to maybe ask questions like Nada was hoping to hear?
Yeah, a lot of people just like to stare, or like, we always hear like little kids, "Mommy, why is she wearing that?" Mm. And it would be better if they came up to us and asked us instead of like just having their own, like as Nada said, assumptions about things.
Talking to Nada Kasim and Zamzam Noor, they're members of United ReSisters of Green Bay, two of the authors of the new book, The First Winter, about the experiences of being Somali Americans, refugees, or the children of refugees in the Green Bay area. And Zamzam, you and the group have been doing public events for a while and now more for the book. What kind of reaction are you getting to United ReSisters and to the new book?
We've been getting a lot of positive reactions. It was really heartwarming and surprising. And yeah, people are responding well to our writings and complimenting us on them.
Now, the book is called The First Winter, and I should ask both of you about winter a little bit. Nada, first of all, you, what was it like in your first Wisconsin winter?
Yeah, for winter, like back in Africa, when it rains, it used to rain with more like frozen. It was never like white and this, and the look of it was really surprising and something new to me, other than seeing it in movies.
And Zamzam, you grew up in Wisconsin, in Minnesota, I think. Snow wasn't anything new to you growing up. How do you explain it to people when you visited in Somalia?
Yeah, I'm really used to snow since I grew up in Minnesota. When I was in Somalia, people never really asked questions about it. Mm-hmm. But the few questions that I did get, I'd just be like imagine going to a freezer for a couple minutes. That's how it feels like.
Nada, do you still feel connected to Somalia? You want to know what's going on there and the fate of the people who are still there?
Yeah. I would love to.
What kind of how do you keep in touch with that, or how do you try to stay on top of that information?
Yeah, most of my family members live there, so I talk to them and they tell me about it.
And Zamzam, again, you didn't grow up there, but you went there for a couple of years. Do you still feel that connection with Somalia?
I really do. I always feel drawn to it, and hopefully, if I become successful over here in America, to take my passion and dreams over there and teach them and help the country grow.
Nada, if you met someone today who had just come to, say, Wisconsin as a refugee from another country, Somalia or wherever in the world, what would you say to them? What would you say to them to prepare them for life in America?
I would tell them to just never be afraid and that they will get through these struggles and will remember all this as happy things they did to get through it.
And Zamzam, what would you say now to Americans who might be meeting a refugee or a refugee's child for the first time ever?
I would say don't be scared. We're people just like you, and just be open and ask questions. We're always happy to answer them.
We'll leave it there. Zamzam, thank you so much for coming up to the studio.
Thank you.
And Nada, thank you for sharing the book with us.
Thank you.
Nada Kasim and Zamzam Noor are members of the United Re-Sisters of Green Bay, two of the authors of the new book, The First Winter. The book is available through Two Shrews Press or at a series of public events in Green Bay this week. You can find out when and where those are by visiting unitedresisters.com. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is taking a different approach to managing a deadly illness in the state's deer population. DNR Secretary Designee Preston Cole tells WPR that the agency is going to focus more on research than on rulemaking in addressing chronic wasting disease.
We need to find out where it is, where it's heading, and do whatever it takes to slow it down.
Last year, former Governor Scott Walker's administration imposed emergency rules requiring more fences at deer farms and limits on the transport of deer carcasses. A legislative committee blocked that effort. CWD was first identified in Wisconsin 17 years ago. It has since been found in 56 of the state's 72 counties. Patrick Durkin is the president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. His columns appear weekly in the Wisconsin Outdoor News and eight other newspapers in the state. He also writes nationally for Meat Eater Media and American Hunter Magazine. Pat, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Good to talk to you again.
Well, we've been talking about CWD. Pat, you've been following it for a whole bunch of years. What do you make of this approach now from the new administration in Wisconsin and how they're handling this?
I guess I'm overall disappointed because when Preston Cole says, we need to be doing more research and he asked, we need to find out where it is and where it's heading. And I think, well, we know where it is. We know pretty much where it's heading. And I guess we also even know how to slow it down. But I think in our state, we just really haven't had the determination to slow it down. We tried slowing it down, 10, 12 years ago. The public, a lot of hunters opposed it. And the legislature basically forced the DNR to back off. And we've been in this kind of treading water mode now for over a decade. So I guess I was kind of, like I say, disappointed because I thought, after all the talk of needing more science, that we really would be seeing more of a scientific approach to the whole thing.
For people who haven't been following this story all along, Pat, how much is at stake with chronic wasting disease in the state's deer herd?
Well, I think it's as far as outdoor recreation, the one big one we have in the state that really generates millions of dollars in direct income and lots of corollary income, into the, whether you're talking about deer processing and sausage making. Different estimates put whitetail deer hunting in our state at over $1 billion industry, and some estimates even go as high as double that. So it's a we have a lot at stake here. People really kind of get to the point where they're not too eager to go out hunting deer because they're uncertain if the deer they shoot is carrying the disease. And right now there's areas of southwestern Wisconsin where over half the deer going past people are carrying that disease, and isn't for deer. It's always fatal. There's no recovering from it.
Are there methods that were working here in Wisconsin or that have worked in other states that we are not currently using to stop the spread?
Yeah, the big one is basically really doing our best to lower the deer herd in those areas with a problem. And if you look back at how Wisconsin handled it first, you know, I think some of the wording initially was unfortunate. You know, DNR talked about trying to eradicate the deer herd itself to eradicate the disease. And they kind of knew that would never happen. That it's very hard to eradicate an animal that hides, you know, in this case, white-tailed deer. But Illinois has been showing that if you go out there and really stay on top of the herd and shoot a lot of deer every year, and you might not see as many deer when you're hunting that way, but at least then you'll have deer to hunt for long term, and they'll always be there at a probably a huntable level. But we have not had the will and determination to make that kind of move.
Why not?
Personally, I think it's myself. I think it's a selfish living the moment approach that too many people have taken. You know, they like to see deer when they're hunting. They think it's, you know, they convince themselves it's not really a problem. And for many years, you know, it looked like for a number of years that really wasn't a problem, that, you know, the deer disease is going to stay down at the 2% range. Well, now we have it in the 48 and 55% rate in some areas for the bucks in the population. So I think it really was this short-sighted, almost arrogant attitude that this is not the problem that the scientists are saying it was.
Talking to Patrick Durkin, he's been following chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin as an outdoor writer for closing in on two decades now, looking at the Evers administration approach to CWD. I mean, is there a productive way to spend research money? Are there questions that could be answered, Pat, that might help point the way to even better solutions?
Yeah, I think the one thing, Rob, that I guess I keep marveling at is here we are we're now heading into our 18th deer season with this disease. We have things on the books right now or things we're trying to get a handle on, but we have not done that. We have these rules like we shouldn't be moving deer around the state, and then unless you take it to a certified taxidermist or a certified deer processor, well, we really haven't even identified what constitutes who these people are and where to find them. And we have I think some of the better programs we're talking about right now are not coming from the DNR. They're not coming from the Department of Ag. They're coming from individual citizens who go out and they're putting dumpsters out in convenient places for people to dump their deer carcasses into deer bones after they're done butchering them. So you don't have these deer bones that are still carrying CWD prions and leave them out in the landscape. So here we're seeing some efforts being made that way, but again, it's being driven by private citizens, not so much by the DNR.
Let's talk about deer farms. I mentioned those emergency rules that would have required, I believe, a second fence, a double fence for deer farms to prevent farmed deer from coming into contact with wild deer. That got dropped. Can you talk about the role of deer farms and rules that have and haven't been there?
Well, you know, the deer farms initially, people, you know, it's a tough one to really get your handle on, Rob, because how do you prove that they really were the ones that brought sick deer into the state and then had them escape or whatever it might be and get on the landscape? And I guess, you know, when you're 18 years down the road and you have now, in this past year, we found over 1,000 deer tested positive in voluntary testing. It's not yet mandatory testing. Just voluntary testing, we found over 1,000 sick wild deer on the landscape. When you have that many sick deer running around the landscape, you think, well, I hope we'll do more to regulate the deer farms and the fences and do a better job monitoring them than we have been doing. But, man, we have so many wild deer right now running around out there that I think it's going to take more than just hammering on the deer farms and there's a problem there. I'll never diminish that. But I think we have a bigger problem with this, how many wild deer are now out there because we've been so passive in our approach.
Now, the Joint Finance Committee, controlled by Republicans, approved $100,000 from hunters' fees to look into creating genetically modified white-tailed deer that would be resistant to CWD. I know at least one deer farm operator was hoping to see that. Did that end up making it into the budget that Governor Evers signed?
Governor Evers, I was happy to see he vetoed that. And I guess I'm just not too keen on the idea of taking money that should be going to hunters to get their deer tested. Hunters provide this money to get their deer tested, and then we're going to turn around and give it to the private sector and never really know for certain if we're going to see any long-term benefit from that. And plus, if you can extend the life of a deer by a few months, you know, by making them more less susceptible to this disease, you know, basically all you're doing is letting a sick deer live a little bit longer to spread its CWD prions into the atmosphere and into the ground. So I guess I wasn't too, I did not like the idea one bit.
If the status quo stays as it is, Pat, we keep what we're doing, we add some research. I mean, where do you see CWD in Wisconsin in the next 4 years or so?
Well, you know, the one thing I should correct is, you know, we're always confused here about, you know, we use this term CWD affected. Well, right now we have, in our state, we have 26 counties that actually have CWD on the landscape. We have about another 7 or 8, 9, I think, that where we found CWD in these captive deer facilities. And then the rest of the counties in that 56 that are considered affected are basically counties nearby proven infected spots. So, you know, right now we have over half the state affected, but as far as the actual number of counties with CWD present, that's 26 of us. But still, what's that, about a third of the state we know for sure we have CWD on the landscape.
And what do you watch for next? What would you like to see the DNR or state lawmakers or whoever takes the lead, what would you like to see them do to try to slow this down in the next year or two?
See, I still think the first thing we should do is get a real good handle on making it convenient for people to dispose of their carcasses in a good, responsible way, not leaving these deer bones out in the landscape where it could just be spreading even more prions out there. I wish we get a handle on that and get dumpsters all over the state in convenient locations and do a lot more mandatory tests in areas where CWD is popping up. We're outside this area, like, you know, Adams County right now, they had tests last year that showed it's possible that we have an 8% infection rate already in parts of one part of Adams County, and yet you don't really hear much effort being made in that area to get on top of that situation. So there's lots of little spots we could be doing a lot more aggressive work and a lot more, I think, just public attention on that right now isn't being focused out there.
Pat, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Great. Thanks, Rob.
That's Patrick Durkin, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, a weekly columnist for several newspapers in the state. He joined us for a look at the state DNR's plan to invest in research instead of more rulemaking aimed at addressing chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin's deer herd. Is this an issue you're watching, that you're focusing on? Does it affect you maybe as a hunter or somebody involved in the business? Let us know what you think. Email ideas@wpr.org. Chance the Snapper is in custody. As we mentioned Friday, an alligator was on the loose last week in Chicago. We have an update. Judith Sears-Poisson, you've been watching this story unfold.
I have been. As a native Chicago, and I was quite interested in this, never having seen an alligator myself growing up there. But as of 1:30 this morning, Chance has been captured. They brought in an expert, Frank Robb, from St. Augustine, Florida. He monitored and tracked Chance for 36 hours straight. He did not sleep, and was able to capture him, showed him off at a press conference. Frank Robb hopefully will get a nap, but then actually tonight he is going to throw out the first pitch at the Cubs game. Tomorrow morning he gets to turn on Buckingham Fountain, which I think is super cool.
Now, I understand city authorities had promised if Chance was apprehended, he would not be killed, and
right,
that sounds like they're going to stick with that.
Yep, they are looking for a sanctuary or a zoo for him to go to. He really captured people people's imaginations and interest. And he was quite debonair at his press conference today. Chance was wearing a black and red plaid bow tie.
Okay. Could be a new team mascot if there's a sports team in Chicago that needs a gator.
I think so.
All right. And we'll be talking about exotic pets that become invasive species tomorrow on the show, a related issue. Judith, thanks.
Sure.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.